Outkick the coverage with Clay Travis live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
Now let's get this party started.
You're listening to Fox Sports Radio.
Right off the top, for those of you waking up on the West Coast, you probably already know because you were watching, but the Dodgers bounce back from a heartbreaking, unbelievable, pulse-pounding loss in Game 4. Clayton Kershaw comes out and wins Game 5. Celebration set it all for Kershaw. And so, as a result, the Dodgers are one game away from winning a World Series title. I'm sure we will be talking about that some on the Tuesday edition of the program and the Wednesday edition of the program. We'll see exactly what happens as that continues to shake out. But we have got a lot of NFL and college football that we are unpacking the results from. And I want to start with Sunday Night Football, where finally the Seahawks lost a close game. They haven't lost a close game in what feels like forever. They were 14-2 coming into this game in a one-score contest. The Cardinals and Kyler Murray and Cliff Kingsbury in what is the toughest division in sports right now, certainly the toughest division in the NFL, they find a way to get a win, and Kyler Murray was scintillating. They overcome what should have been a made field goal in overtime. Russell Wilson uncharacteristically makes a bunch of mistakes, and as a result, we end up with three interceptions, and Isaiah Simmons makes a huge play in overtime to set up Gonzalez for redemption and also to avoid Cliff Kingsbury getting overly criticized, because the Cardinals were running the ball like crazy. And then they just decide that they're going to set up for the field goal on second down. They give up 5 yards, and then the field goal, they aren't ready, so they're going to have a delay of game, so they have to take a penalty. But the ball still gets snapped, and they make the field goal. Then they take, but they've taken the timeout. Then they come back out and miss wide left. So it looked like it was going to be a real mess for the Cardinals there, with the Seahawks getting the ball back and driving. But credit to the Arizona defense, which was blitzing from every angle imaginable and never really seemed to allow Russell Wilson to get comfortable. And as a result, Isaiah Simmons makes a huge overtime play. And by the way, you may remember him from Clemson. He's a rookie, but just how freakishly talented and athletic is he? That was an incredible play. And so the Cardinals get their second straight win now, I believe it is, over the Seahawks. Remember, they beat the Seahawks late last year in a big upset, but for a lot of people was maybe Kyler Murray's coming along in a big way. So that is the big takeaway from Sunday Night Football, as well as the Dodgers getting the win in Game 5. Now, a ton of other stories that we have been getting into and we're continuing to discuss. Steelers-Titans lived up to the hype. The Steelers are the only undefeated team remaining in the entirety of the NFL, as they were able to sneak away, I would say. After getting up 27-7, the Steelers were in danger of the Titans coming all the way back and scoring 20 unanswered points to send the game into overtime. But Steven Gostkowski missed what should have been a very makeable 45-yard field goal. As a result, the Steelers are the only undefeated team remaining in the entirety of the NFL. They're 6-0 now. Now, on top of that, as if that were not wacky and difficult enough of a way to have that game end, the other scenario that's out there that I believe is going to continue to be unpacked is, what in the world is going on with the New England Patriots? This dynasty appears completely dead. And not only that, Cam Newton looks like he is finished. And I think this could be the hubris finally catching up with Bill Belichick, who believed that Tom Brady had nothing left, and that he thought, I really do think this is true, he thought Brady was washed up and he could replace him, and the Patriots would continue to roll. Well, this weekend was a cold dash of reality, if that was your theory, because Brady, on the road in Vegas, went 33 of 45 for 369 yards, four touchdowns, no INTs, and he had a 127 rating. Meanwhile, the Patriots quarterbacks, Cam Newton and Jarrett Stidham, went 15 of 25 for just 162 yards, no touchdowns, four interceptions, a 39.5 rating overall as passers. This has already turned into a debate that we all thought we were going to have about who won the divorce. That's what we've been talking about on this program since Brady decided to leave New England and go to Tampa Bay. And the question was, would Belichick or Brady win the divorce? I don't even think this is a challenge anymore. The answer is, beyond a shadow of a doubt, Tom Brady has won this divorce. He's got the Bucs. And I really do believe this. I think the Bucs are the best team in the NFL right now. Now, I know we've still got a lot of games to play, but when you think about adding Antonio Brown to a team that already has Godwin and to a team that already has Evans and some proven pass catchers, we're starting to see Rob Gronkowski step up his level of play also. When you start to think about all the weapons this Tampa Bay offense is going to have and how good of a defense they also have in terms of the balancing act, I know they've got two losses. I know they lost to the Bears, and I know they lost to the Saints, but the best team in the NFC right now, it really does look like it's the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So, especially with this Seahawks defense not being able to stop anybody, I know the Bears beat the Bucs, but I'm not sold at all on Nick Foles being able to lead this Bears team the rest of the way. To me, the value play, the most impressive team out there right now in the NFC is Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And if I had to predict, right now who's going to play in the Super Bowl, the two best teams, in my opinion, in the NFL are Tampa Bay Buccaneers in the NFC. And I still believe that it was kind of a fun snow game. And I was wrong. It's one of the picks that we got wrong. We went 5-2 on our Outkick six pack. Remember, I gave you an extra bonus pick. Didn't do as well in college football, but we are on fire with our NFL picks right now. And I thought that the Broncos would give the Chiefs a little bit of a game. It didn't happen. So I know they lost a game. I know they lost to the Raiders, but I think the best team in the AFC is the Chiefs. That's who I would still make the favorite to advance to the Super Bowl. And I also believe that the best team in the NFC is the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So right now, near the halfway point of the season, I'll continue to update you as we move forward. I think the two best teams are the Bucs and the Chiefs. That's who I would bet is going to actually meet in the Super Bowl at the end of the year. But that is still a ways away. In the meantime, we're about to be joined by Joel Klatt. He is Fox's lead college football analyst. I encourage you to hang out for him. That should be a fun conversation.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
The loathsome Joel Klatt joins us now at Joel Klatt on Twitter. And it was a big weekend. So I went to watch my first college football game in person. I watched Alabama just dismantle Tennessee. But I think Alabama is going to and has been dismantling a lot of football teams this year. And I think there's a lot more that are going to come before all is said and done. But we bring in Joel to talk about the Big Ten returning and more. You were up in Columbus. What was the vibe like for the return of the Big Ten in that game between Nebraska and Ohio State?
Yeah, I mean, listen, they were through the roof excited. You know, Scott Frost was, the Nebraska players, everybody for Ohio State. There's no doubt. All those Zoom calls, they were just like, man, we can't wait to get out there. That being said, you know, I've done now a fair share of my game. I think seven games I've done, I think, if I'm counting correctly. But this was the first one with zero fans. You know, I've had a game canceled on me on a Friday, that Baylor-Houston game. But this was the first one with zero fans. At least even the very first one of the season, Arkansas State versus Kansas State, there was about 11,000 people in there. There was a band there. Same with Oklahoma, Texas, the Red River game. There was about 23,000 people there. So this one was, I thought, the most odd, you know, and to be honest, like, it just, it it was so disappointing in some respect because there was so much quality play on the field, and in particular for guys that you could tell had dreamed of playing there, were part of a huge recruiting class, like their wide receiver Jackson Smith and Jigba, who made that unbelievable touchdown catch in the back of the end zone. And it's kind of like that play and his career, like he deserved 104,000 people there, you know?
Yeah.
And obviously that's not possible, but it definitely felt odd, Clay. It was the first time this season that I sat back during a couple of commercial breaks and I was like, man, this is a bit of a struggle from an atmosphere standpoint.
We're talking with Joel Klatt. What did you take away from the game on the field itself? Did Ohio State, I know it was the first game of the season, but did Ohio State look to you like one of the four best teams in college football?
Oh, without question. And I think that the gap between the top of college football right now and even like the next tier is really wide. And I would say even Notre Dame is more next tier than they are top tier, right? I think that there are four unbelievable teams in college football. And I include Georgia, even though they don't have a great quarterback right now, but I include Georgia just because their roster is so complete. And obviously Clemson, Alabama, and then Ohio State is in that category. They're the only four teams in the country that have double-digit five-star recruits on their team. You know, there's 20 five-star recruits overall in the Big Ten Conference. 20, that's it, Clay. 14 of them are on Ohio State's roster. So they're just so much better than everybody else. And Justin Fields, and this is what separates the top three, Clemson, Alabama, and Ohio State from Georgia, is that those top three have legitimate Heisman-level top-end college football talent at the quarterback position, and Ohio State also has that at the wide receiver spot. Their offensive line was really good. There's not a doubt in my mind that Ohio State is one of the four best, and I would say one of the three best teams in college football right now.
So you tweeted this out that I thought was really interesting, and I screenshotted it because I was like, I want to bring this up when you come on the show the next time. And I'm scrolling through my phone to find it, and I've got it right here. Five-star recruits on roster by conference. This is a tweet you sent out last week. The SEC has 54. The Big Ten has 20. The ACC has 15. The Pac-12 has 13. The Big 12 has 11. Now, people out there are going to scream, well, J.J. Watt was a two-star, you know, like people always say. But in general, the more five stars you have, the more talented your football team is because there are so few of them. And you broke it down here, and you might have just reiterated it, but Georgia has 16 five stars. Ohio State has 14. Alabama has 12. And Clemson has 11. The entire Big 12 has 11. And if you eliminate Georgia and Alabama from the roster, and again, Georgia and Alabama have 28 five stars, the SEC would still, even without Georgia and Alabama having any players at all, and Georgia and Alabama are clearly the most talented, they would still have the highest total of five stars in college football, even if you take away all those numbers from Georgia and Alabama. The point on all this is it's really pretty extraordinary how talented those four teams are relative to everybody else.
Yeah, and that's why I've been on the record a few different times. I'm growing, I'm changing, Clay. I would say that like my feelings towards the playoff have changed over this first iteration of the playoff. I really do feel like while it's so much fun, the unintended consequences of the playoff are that it's really hurting the sport because the separation of the haves and the have-nots is not happening at 15, 16, 17, and 18. It's happening at 3 and 4, right? Like, there's four teams that legitimately can win the national championship this year. That's it.
Do you think expanding the playoff to 8 would help that because more teams would be able to think that they have a chance to get to the playoff, which might allow? So I'm fascinated by this in general.
I don't know, and this is I'm really wrestling with this, and you know I sound like some sort of philosopher, which I'm clearly not, but like I'm wrestling with this right now, and I'm thinking about it because on one hand, I am starting to believe deep down that the playoff is bad for college football overall because of what's happening at the top and not happening everywhere else. And that being said, if you grow the playoff, these conferences, because they own the playoff, Clay, will have automatic berths. And you could say, like, well, that's great. Well, is it great? Because if you have automatic berths, you automatically nullify the importance of any non-conference game that is ever played. Like, it just doesn't matter. It's literally an exhibition. And I don't know if I like that either. So I don't know what the fix is, man. Like, I wish I did. I'm going to be thinking really hard about this year, and hopefully I can think and come up with some sort of idea of how we can fix this. Because here's the other part of this that I think needs to be said. In the playoff era, okay, there's been only three teams that have made the playoff, just made the playoff, that have had a recruiting ranking of their average of their last 4 years before that playoff appearance of 15 or lower. Does that make sense? Like a national recruiting ranking,
yeah,
average,
yeah,
over 4 years, right before they make it, of 15 or lower. That was Oregon the first year, then it was Michigan State, then it was Washington, right? And so it's never happened since then. So I just don't know. Like, you talk about expanding the playoff. Yes, that's probably the answer, because at this point, when it's just the four best teams in college football, we already know who they are. We just do. And that's, I think that's frustrating for everybody else, because what's the avenue? Like, let's say Oklahoma State, okay? Bring up Oklahoma State right now. They had a huge win against Iowa State. If they go undefeated, I would say, like, they should deserve a spot in the playoff, and they'll probably go to the playoff. But they would be one of those teams that don't average a recruiting class in the top 15 over the last 4 years. It's actually like 40th. So in college football, we've turned Oklahoma State into the George Mason of the NCAA tournament. Like, I don't love that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I think the other aspect of this is it also a function of how much better recruiting rankings are getting, right?
Yes.
Because some people would say, again, who would get upset when all the attention goes to recruiting rankings, they cite, you know, aberrations. And for people out there who are not paying attention to the overall talent that's coming in, yes, there are two-star athletes that develop into first-round talent. But
sure,
there are way more two-stars, right? There are way more three-stars. There are relatively few four- and five-stars, and they are overwhelmingly overrepresented when it comes time to the NFL draft. And I think that's a sign that the recruiting rankings in general in football, because a lot of these guys get into camps now, you know, the tape is better. There's just better analysis. And I think, you know, the 7-on-7s are so much more commonplace. It's a lot easier to rank the talent. And I wonder how much of the talent is the top guys say, well, I want to go somewhere where I can win a championship. And
that's
what
right.
They're recognizing is there's relatively few places that they can do that.
Yeah, and I wonder if NIL, the name, image, and likeness, is going to weed this out. Because let's be honest, right? Like, wouldn't you rather be the big fish in the pond?
Yeah, that's a good argument.
When it comes to name, image, and likeness.
For people out there who argue that it's going to make the rich richer, I think it actually creates an opportunity for the poorer schools to actually be able to compete on some levels in a way that they are not now.
Let's just bring it up like this. Would you rather be – so Ohio State, just in their starting 22 players, right, 11 on offense, 11 on defense, 7 of them were recruited as 5-star players. That's insane, right? 7 of them. By the way, LSU has 7 total 5-star players. Ohio State has 7 starters that were 5-stars. Rather than being the 7th 5-star player for Ohio State starting, trying to make money in Columbus on name, image, and likeness – wouldn't you rather be the only 5-star player on, let's say, I don't know, sake of argument, Minnesota, in Minneapolis?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I think you could probably make $100,000 more being the only 5-star player on Minnesota rather than the 7th starter that's a 5-star player at Ohio State. So,
Minnesota is a big Power 5 conference school. I think it's possible. I'm just tossing a school out there. Let's say you're a stud from near Hattiesburg, Mississippi. You can be a player at Alabama, Auburn, Ole Miss, you know, one of those schools, but you're like the 20th best player in their class. Or you can go to Hattiesburg and the local car dealer in Hattiesburg will put you on a billboard and give you $100,000. Wouldn't, I mean, I think there are a lot of dudes out there that ordinarily would say, oh, I'd rather be the 20th best player in the recruiting class of Alabama or Auburn or Ole Miss or whoever it is. But instead, I'm going to be the number one recruit in Southern Miss, and everybody in my small area is going to know me, and I'll have more value there.
I think that's exactly right. And we'll just have to see, because I think what you're also going to see is right now, you know, athletic directors are going to their biggest boosters and begging for money in order to increase the lifestyle of their athletes on campus. They're going to build them, you know, better locker rooms, better services, all this stuff. So they're pouring money into the quality of life of their student athlete. Well, what's going to happen, and I've had off-the-record conversations with a number of athletic directors who have told me point blank, well, I'm just going to go to my boosters and tell them to just give that money straight to the player on some sort of billboard and not give it to me. And now
right.
I just won't have three juice bars a day. We'll have one juice bar a day. I'm going to cut down my cost by, let's call it, $2 million over the course of 12 months. And that $2 million will find its way to my players just in a different avenue. So maybe the rich will get richer. Maybe this will water things down. I think it's a fascinating conversation, though, in particular when we're sitting here and it's the week before Halloween. It's Halloween week, right? I mean, here we are. It's Monday of Halloween. And Clay, we know who's going to play for the national championship. We just do. I don't know how to break this to anybody, but the national championship game is going to be two of the best three teams in the country. It's either going to be Clemson, Alabama, or Ohio State playing each other in that game.
Is there any, and I think I know the answer based on what you just said, but is there any way that Penn State can upset the Big Ten apple cart of Buckeye expectation on Halloween night in Happy Valley? Ordinarily, you would say, oh, that's going to be a ruckus atmosphere. That's going to be crazy. You never know what happens at night in college football in front of 100,000 fans. Wacky things can occur. But now it's going to be a night game with literally no one in the stands.
Yeah, and the road teams are just at such an advantage. Look at Michigan and the autonomy that they were – yeah, and the autonomy that they were able to operate. When I say autonomy on offense, when you can operate with autonomy, that means that you have full disposal of every tool.
No communication issues. It's just like a scrimmage.
Cadence, plays, you can change, but you can do whatever you want. It is just like a scrimmage. And how much more advantageous is that for a guy making his first start? And they took advantage, man. They pounded Minnesota, pounded them. And good for them, right? It was good to watch that offensive line play and the running backs play. But so here at the beginning of the, you know, my studying in the offseason, I'm like, that's the one game that I look at and Ohio State's going to have trouble with, because they always have trouble there in the whiteout. Everybody does. Michigan can't beat Penn State in State College. Remember a couple of years ago, it's the game that saved James Franklin's job when they blocked the field goal against Ohio
yep.
State and beat that talented Buckeye team. Like, that is an incredibly tough environment that is just completely nullified now. And Ohio State is sorry, Penn State, but way better than the Nittany Lions, in particular with Journey Brown out, in particular with Micah Parsons out, and in particular when Penn State's coming off a game in which their coach completely botched the game. Like, they should be walking out of Bloomington with a win, and James Franklin botches the game, just period. You can't mismanage a game worse than he did, and now they've got to go play Ohio State, and Ohio State is going to be ready, and I think that they're going to play really well. I just don't see Penn State beating them. Is there a chance? Sure. I mean, there's always a chance. I don't see anybody in the Big Ten playing within two scores, Clay, of Ohio State during the course of the year.
And that's going to be fascinating to watch as we go forward. Another big storyline, obviously, in the Big Ten is going to be what exactly happens as, you know, there's, I'm not going to bring you in to be sort of a virologist to try to analyze this thing, but just in a broad concept, are you concerned about the fact that the Big Ten doesn't really have a safety net to games, right? Like, if players or games have to get postponed or canceled, it's not like the ACC, the Big 12, and the SEC, which were able, knock on wood, so far to kind of adjust games, and so far we haven't had to miss any conference games. Are you concerned about the lack of safety net that exists now for the Big 10, given that the season has started?
Only in the sense that I don't know what the minimum requirement is going to be for the committee. First of all, I don't think that they will set a minimum, but there certainly will be an internal minimum, you would think.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that's the only – because there's going to be games canceled in the Big Ten, you know, just –
And not postponed, canceled because of the way their schedule is set up.
They can't postpone it. They just can't. There's the, like you were talking about, there's no wiggle room. And it's going to happen. And they put themselves behind the eight ball because they wanted to – and again, this is because they canceled – they postponed the season originally. And so when they do bring it back, they have egg on their face. So what do? They throw out some ridiculous 21-day –
right.
Auto sit out for a player that has a positive test, which is, to be quite honest with you, pretty ridiculous and a frustration from the coaches and some of the athletic directors that had to give that up in order to get the season. And trust me, I've talked with coaches and athletic directors that have talked with the medical personnel like at the premier institutes in the country that are treating COVID. One of them is in Omaha, by the way, that treated the very first COVID patient in the country. And so they've been at this from the forefront. And, you know, there have been people told, like, listen, the 21-day thing is the dumbest thing of all time. So this is a huge virtue signal. Like, hey, we postpone and we're coming back, but we still think it's more dangerous than you think it is. So we're going to have this 21-day mark, which is going to really wreak havoc on their schedule.
And so that still remains to be determined. I've seen you tweeting about this. I heard from a ton of Nebraska fans. The targeting rule in college football remains a mess.
It's egregious.
I think two Nebraska players are going to have to miss portions of the second game. What is the fix here? I mean, we've been talking about this, I feel, for like 5 years in college football in particular, and it's still not fixed.
Well, and it's only not fixed because of the loathsome. I mean, you say I'm loathsome.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, sorry to those of you out there that are this person out there, but the loathsome, like, injury litigators out there. You were a lawyer. You know,
I'm a loathsome person on many levels. Yes, I was a lawyer. I've adopted basically the most hated professions that anybody can be in. I'm in the media. And I am a lawyer. I think the combination of those two makes me basically the vilest human on earth.
Well, and accurately so. So, you know, but the fear of litigation, you know, is so abundant in the administration levels of college football and college athletics, intercollegiate athletics. And so they have to present this this idea of safety, this facade of safety, and they are unwilling to backtrack. Because if they do walk back the targeting rule and create levels to it, and I'll talk about the fix, but if they do walk it back and try to, quote, fix it, it will look to litigators as if they're being soft in the player safety issues. So that's why they're unwilling to do it. And yet, they're unwilling also to fix the game clock issue, which is that in college football, we still stop the game clock after first downs, like it's little league football.
Yes.
So that the old guys can run the chains and
yes.
set them. It's the dumbest thing of all time. I've done the math, and did you know that a normal team that's not going hyperspeed on offense, a normal team could save about 95 snaps over the course of a season if the game clock would just run after first down. So you wouldn't see it. It wouldn't affect the game whatsoever, but you would reduce the total number of snaps on your football team by about 90 to 95. Teams that go hyper fast would be about 120. Well, guess what that is? That's a full game of contact.
Right.
So you're meaning to tell me that you're out there, you know, the champion of player safety, and you're unwilling to do that small, minute clock change that would actually remove tangible snaps of the football from those players? Give me a break. So we go back to the targeting rule. Here's how I would fix it. I would create two levels for it. In the egregious instances where you've got clear intent to use the crown of the helmet as a weapon, in particular high on an opponent, I think that player should and is ejected. And a case where you've got targeting, you've got forcible contact to the head or neck area, but it's in the normal course of football. That should be a 15-yard penalty, and the player stays in the game. I'm just trying to retain players' ability to play the sport that they love. We've got now Dante Williams, a really good player for Nebraska, who I thought got thrown out of the game on a really poor call. Mike Pereira agreed with me, and now he's going to have to miss the first half against Wisconsin next week. Cam Taylor-Britt, their corner, thrown out, missing the first half of the Wisconsin game. So two of their secondary players, and it's a good secondary, in a year in which Scott Frost is trying to build momentum, in particular when he's trying to build up his recruiting base, and now they've got to play a team in their division that's, you know, some picked them to win, with a quarterback who may be out there or maybe not, because the Big Ten has this 21-day rule out there, but there was 20 of 21 in his first game starting against Illinois last Friday night. It's a mess, dude. It's an absolute mess. I don't understand why these guys in the replay booth won't just take the targeting off. If there's any question whatsoever, just take it off so the kid can play. Like, what are we doing? And ejecting a player from the game should only be held for the egregious instances where there is clear intent to use the crown of the helmet as a weapon.
Joel Klatt, fired up. I appreciate it, my man. We will talk to you next week.
Love it. See you guys.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Appreciate all of you who've spent your Monday morning hanging out with us. We've talked mostly NFL and college football because this is an NFL and a college football show, usually during football season. But I do want to mention the Dodgers, for those of you waking up on the West Coast, taking a 3-2 series lead after a absolutely wild ending to Game 5, where the Dodgers were a strike away from going up 3-1. And the reaction from Clayton Kershaw, who, when he lost Game 4, it felt like when the Dodgers went down 3-1, that Clayton Kershaw's chances to win a World Series title were going to vanish again. Instead, the Dodgers fight back, win three more games, and get into the World Series. And then Kershaw comes out and pitches very well in Game 5. The Dodgers, I don't want to jinx anything, but the Dodgers are now one win away from winning their first World Series since 1988. And Clayton Kershaw may have a chance to be the MVP of the series, considering how he's pitched in two different games. But far more important than that to him is getting that World Series championship for Los Angeles for the first time ever, if he could manage to do that in his career, and finally erase the one part of his glittering resume that is not 100% golden, and take him out of the category of best to have never won a champion. He's been the best pitcher probably of his generation, and this would put him in the mix with everybody else who has won championships over time, and would also take him out of the category that we had this discussion about, what, 10 days ago or whatever the heck it was, about Clayton Kershaw potentially as Major League Baseball's version of Dan Marino, as Major League Baseball's version of James Harden or Giannis, depending on exactly how you would shake all that out. It is pretty interesting to contemplate how his overall resume changes immensely if the Dodgers are able to win Game 6 or Game 7 and win a World Series title. Now, I know a lot of you out there were watching not just the Dodgers. You're also watching a fabulous Sunday night football game. But I know for many of you waking up on the West Coast in particular, you are monster Dodger fans, including Danny G and Roberto. And by the way, they still wouldn't believe on Friday that we actually had the cardboard cutout. So I appreciate Danny G sending that to me so I could send it to everybody. He was watching Fox Bet Live, so I could let them know that, hey, we were actually taken care of there. But again, a lot to get into with what the overall legacy will be for the Dodgers if they can win that game, Game 6 or Game 7. But for many of you out there, I know you felt it when you saw Clayton Kershaw exulting when that final out was gained. and you are tantalizingly close if you are an LA Dodger fan to finding a way to get that tantalizing championship that has just been just beyond your reach. I want to encourage all of you out there listening to us right now, make sure you go download the podcast, subscribe if you haven't already. There is a lot to get to that you should be encouraged and entertained by, I believe. Want to have as many of you listening as possible. Great show. My thanks to Joel Klatt, who just joined us and talked about some of the challenges and some of the flaws that are out there in the world of college football. Also, we talked with Sean Merriman in the second hour of the program, but like I said, talking a little bit of Dodgers here to finish off the program for the day. That Muncy home run, by the way, and stare down into this as it rolled into the stands was pretty outstanding as well. But the Dodgers in incredible position to win their first World Series title since 1988. This has been Outkick the Coverage on Fox Sports Radio. Much more to come tomorrow as we'll give you all the breakdowns on everything with the NFL complete, and we'll hopefully find some more news out about the situation in the Big Ten as it pertains to the allegations of positive tests. Hopefully they are all considered to be false positives. All that still to come. Appreciate you. This has been Outkick the Coverage on Fox Sports Radio.